Welcome to this On Watch episode in recognition of the IMO's International Day for Women in Maritime. This year's theme is Mobilizing Networks for Gender Equality. It was my great pleasure to speak with two extraordinary women in our industry who exemplify this theme. Captain Karen Davis and Margaret K. Doyle, both graduates of the U.S. Merchant Marine Academy at Kings Point. Karen sailed as AB to Master on tankers and currently heads OCIMF. Margaret, with two master's degrees in engineering, is the Alternative Fuels Program Manager for a U.S.-based bunker provider and president of nonprofit Port Vision 50, which she founded. Let's have a listen to their journey. So I want to welcome Karen, and I want to welcome Margaret to On Watch. This is our podcast that will be aired on the IMO Women in Shipping Day. So welcome.
Thanks, Kim. Happy to be here.
It's great to have you both here. And one of the things that I think is remarkable about both of you is that you went to the U.S. Merchant Marine Academy at Kings Point. And I think you were about a year apart, but you were essentially there at the same time or more or less the same time. But let me just ask, I think I'll ask Karen to kick off. This was back in the 80s. Tell me a little bit about what it was like to go to the Merchant Marine Academy.
Well, you're right. It was in the 80s. It was an incredible experience. Challenging, I'd say, just if you could round it out. The first year of women was 1978. So I joined the academy in 1982. I was a year behind Margaret. So she was an upperclassman to me. I came to the academy not knowing really what it was all about. I grew up in the Midwest. I had a brother who had joined the academy and was graduating that year, but he had told me nothing, because he wanted it to be fair and he didn't want people to think I had come with the crib notes. So I showed up at the academy in a dress and heels and had a big suitcase. And within the first day, you lose the suitcase, you lose your identity, you lose all your things, and they cut off all your hair by this terrific barber that we called the Huff. I'm sure Margaret can remember that. So I showed up not knowing what I was going to do when I got there. But since I had come from the Midwest, from a very, very capable, tough family, I was ready for a challenge. And so I think the physical part of it was challenging. The mental part was challenging. But I came from parents who were quite strict. So showing up, I was ready for anything, including heels and a skirt and any parties that were going to go on that I never got to attend.
How about you, Margaret? Did you have the requisite wardrobe?
I knew a little bit about Kings Point because my oldest brother went to West Point and he had gotten into Kings Point. And I actually was looking at West Point and my brother said to me, they're not ready for you. I don't want you going there. Now I look back and he was right. And plus I had a grandfather who was a chief engineer with Royal Dutch Shell. So I had a little bit of an idea, but my story of the first day is my mom and I did all, we did the research. So I had a lovely Dorothy Hamill cut and I sat down with the Huff, the horrible barber there. And I said, oh, there's no need to cut my hair. My mom and I researched this. I just, I'm going to be fine. And he proceeded to just go brrr. So for the 2 weeks when they scream and yell at you, the only thing I could do to fight back was I never combed my hair in 2 weeks. I will send a picture that ended up in Newsday. I am a hot mess getting screamed at by this guy, Van Rexgillard. And him thinking, I know people look at me going, she's not going to make it. I thought, oh no, don't underestimate me. That'll be fun. It was a great, we say Kings Point, it was a great place to be from, but no, the relationships you made with both men and women there are priceless. And I, and Karen will say the same thing.
Yeah, I can say that the men and the women went through similar experiences, right?
Yep.
So you had the same haircut as the guys?
No, they just did a terrible job at it. It was, and the women now don't even have to cut their hair. They used to be just plebes had to cut their hair. Now they don't even have to. They just they have to have it up, which I have a little bit of opinion on because, you go in there and they would, like I said, you could go in with the nicest haircut and they were going to take care of it. And it was pretty bad. Like I said, I'll forward a picture and you can all have a good giggle over it.
Yeah, I think part of that was trying to keep us from worrying about our look. Right. We had 3-minute showers and we dressed all in the same gear. It was really to cut down on prep time. But I think they also wanted to take that beauty element out of it. I remember the Huff just grabbing what I had left and cutting it at the top. Right. So there was.
Wow. I think it must also be an equalizer, too, because everyone sort of, comes in and sort of loses their some of their individuality at the beginning just to be molded from day one.
They tell you on day one, look to your left, look to your right. There's a good chance that person's not going to be there. So you want to be the person in the middle.
Very good. And I guess both of you were the people in the middle. So
we made it.
Yeah, you made it. You made it. Let's talk a little bit about what you've done with that kind of background. And I know, Karen, that you have sailed third mate to master on tankers, but can you just take a little bit and go from the Kings Point background to actually sailing as an officer?
Sure. Yeah. So when you graduate with a deck officer's license, it's U.S. Coast Guard unlimited tonnage, third mate. And you also have your Bachelor of Science. In 1986, the unions had broken, so it was very difficult to get on a ship. I had sailed as cadet on tankers mostly, so I knew I wanted to be in oil and gas. But when I got out of school, there was no mate's job, so I took an able-bodied seaman's job on a tramp tanker going all around the world. So my first year was spent as able-bodied seaman, which I think was really powerful, because when you start as officer, having had some time in the unlicensed rank, you really understand what they go through as an unlicensed person. And you also know where they're hiding, when they're hiding, how they cut corners to survive the hours. You really have this deeper understanding of the work that they do. So I did finally get my third officer's job with Atlantic Richfield, ARCO Marine, and that was U.S. West Coast VLCCs, and I spent all of my time working for them, working through the ranks of third mate up to master. And I survived about 5 years, almost six as master, and then became Captain Mom. And I remember calling my manager at that time and saying, George, I'm not going to be able to go back to sea. And immediately he said, oh, so you're having a baby? Why don't you come ashore? So it was this immediate opportunity to go from sailing on ships for a long time and transitioning to shoreside, which I think today people may not understand that there's a clear linkage that if you spend time at sea, there's a career on the other side. I spent 6 years at home with my kids and then wanted to get back into the working life. And I called up that same guy and said, hey, George, I'm ready to come back to sea. And he said, we've got a job for you. So it was as easy to leave as it was to go back. So, I think when I talk to young women who are worried about that, I say people will remember you on the last day of your job. So just because you've been away for a while, you can always go back. That's what you leave as their memory. And then from there, I really went into sort of the operations side of those ships on which I had sailed. I was superintendent, director of operations. I did training. I did governance and standards. I did everything that you could do to work the other side of the operations. And then I hit upon a really exciting job, which was Marine Assurance Manager for our global operations. And for 12 years, I was able to travel around the world, ensuring that the ships and the boats that we hired were really safe places for people to work. So that included not only tankering, but the offshore industry and some barging. So I went from going deep sea tankering into the offshore industry. And at some point I thought this is like jumping off the bridge wing without a life jacket, because I really knew nothing about the offshore industry. And now I was trying to manage safety within it. So I have a lot of thanks to give to all those people who kind of pulled me up and trusted that I could learn that part of the business too. So that just gave me my next jumping off point.
So assurance means essentially vetting for quality and safety, things like that?
It's making sure that you're not importing unsafe practices into your work, right? So it's vetting the vessels to make sure that they're suitable for your charter. It's making sure that those who operate the vessels have safety management systems that are actually worthwhile, that are usable by the people on board the ships. It does entail a lot of traveling around, getting on board the ships, getting your boots on the deck and getting to know those people. So it has many elements of building the safety culture around the company, even on those vessels that you're chartering.
Very good. And let's go to you, Margaret, now. I know you had a little bit of a different path, but how, when you look back with your educational background, how did you leverage your time at the Merchant Marine Academy into what you've made as your career?
Yeah, sure. I went to grad school, and then it was just so lucky. My husband was getting his full-time MBA at the University of Virginia. So I left the maritime industry for 2 years, and I worked for a venture capital company down in Charlottesville, Virginia. And I knew then that I missed the maritime industry so much. So I was actually at home. My son Jack, who is now 31, I was home with him, and I saw an ad in the back of Marine Log magazine. And I called this guy named Tim Colton, who's pretty famous in the industry. He was G captain before people realized what G captain could be. And the thing is, if you can work for Tim Colton, you can work for anybody. So I drove down I hadn't had Jack. I was pregnant with Jack, and I drove down and I met with Tim Colton, and we just kind of hit it off. And he was looking for a person that would be a technical secretary for the Chemical Carriers Association. He had won the contract, but it was so busy. And I had sailed on chemical tankers a little bit, so I knew a little bit about it. And I just I literally threw myself into the work. We lived in Pennsylvania, and I drove down 2 days a week down to Washington, D.C., and I ran the Chemical Carriers Association for Tim Colton until he decided to go into shipbuilding, and then I took it on my own. And I literally learned everything I could about chemical tankers. Just read, would go, would vet the ships with some of the inspectors. I became a CDI inspector, even though I probably shouldn't have been, things like that. I just took, and everything I wanted to know about chemical carriers, I learned. And then from there, what happened in 2003, when I was running the Chemical Carriers Association, I don't know if you remember this, the big four carriers were all, they were accused of collusion. Again, I was unaware of this. So luckily, a lovely organization called Intertanko, who had always wanted my 600-ship fleet, said, come work for us. So I worked for Intertanko for 10 years and out of their U.S., their Washington, D.C. office. And what I really gained working for Intertanko and CCA was I was able to go to IMO for 15 years as a delegate for various delegations. And that's life-changing work,
Yeah, no kidding. Yeah, no kidding.
So that was great. And so I've on and off, I've been worked for nonprofits. And I made the pivot. I was actually in a meeting down in Florida. It was a MARAD meeting. And I saw a guy named John Hatley, who's class of 76, I think, from KP, very brilliant man, works for Wärtsilä. And he was talking about natural gas as fuel. And I was hooked, and I made the pivot in that direction to actually go and look into training, because I had gone to IMO and had been lucky to sit in some of these training meetings that they were developing the training for LNG as a fuel. So I was able to kind of pivot into that, and it's been fascinating work. You know, it is still a fossil fuel. I get that. And then from there, I dug deep and I decided I want to really look into all these fuels and basically taught myself everything I could know about alternative fuels. And it's really, it's been fascinating. The experience has been great, but I will be the first one to tell you, and Karen will say the same, we have a long way to go. And IMO relative to alternative fuels and GHG reductions, they really need to, some things need to really happen this July. So that's kind of in 21, I made the decision when I was kind of during the pandemic, the whole ports team for my other employer, Eagle LNG, they let them all go right before we were about to bid on some small scale LNG in California. So I was just kind of home, and I decided to start the not-for-profit Port Vision 50, and actually it's been chugging along pretty well. We've gotten a couple grants, and we're really looking at some things that will be really game changers for our industry if we actually get some of these regulations changed. But yeah, and then the other thing that Karen and I have been lucky enough to be a part of is First 10 Forward, and I'll let Karen talk a little bit about that first.
Yeah, there's a really great picture, I think, on the website that shows at a Kings Point reunion, we got together and we talked about how could we make a difference. These were women who had been out in industry for a while and really wanted to give back. And so we thought about how we could do that to give back to girls and women. And we wanted to do it in a way that was not overly organized, not stiff. So the idea was to give an opportunity to women to come and go each year and to try to drive this, keeping our network together. But the background about giving is that in order to be a member that year, you donate. And then during the annual event, we all get together. And those that have chosen a charitable organization, they spend 6 minutes or less telling a story, pitching for their charitable organization without any PowerPoints, with no audio visual. So it really is a bit of a storytelling moment. And interestingly enough, you get 6 minutes to pitch, but then you've got several people around the room, those members, who will quiz you on why that organization should really get the money. So although we don't give a lot of money, the money that we give really comes from our hearts. And I think this is our sixth year, or we had our sixth year of giving, and we've given $95,000 to date to six different organizations. So it's powerful. But it's powerful, the giving, but it's more powerful in the fact that we all get back together. And because of the experience that we had at Kings Point, we're bonded within the first 10 minutes, whether we were in the same class and have known each other for 40 years, or whether we come from different classes. There's this thread of experience that we all share, and a deep understanding without saying anything of what that means to us. So people who come and go are automatically and instantly part of the group that gets together every year.
Margaret, what can you say? I mean, you've got, tell me a little bit about some of the recipients.
It's been fascinating. Karen actually, she pitched and won 1 year. Our first year, we actually, what people don't realize is Kings Point has a certain fees associated with it that aren't covered. So you can come out of Kings Point, even having worn men's clothes and been screamed at, you can come out with some debt. So the first year we gave it to an incoming plebe and two rising plebes, and we basically covered their fees for a year. You know, your laptop, your uniforms, things like that, that were used to be covered are no longer covered. That was one of them. We've had a deep dive into looking at girls for STEM. There was one organization here in New Jersey. Basically, it was scholarships to send these middle schoolers to STEM camp.
That was called the Award to the Atlantic Women's Charitable Organization.
Yeah, that was, you know, and then it was cute. And then we had a Zoom where the girls came on and talked about their experience.
Oh, that's cool.
They were adorable. Yeah, so we've had a whole range. Karen, do you want to talk about the latest ones? I thought, Karen, what I loved about this one, our friend Laura pitched, is that she didn't win 1 year and she came back the next year and pitched it again. And she won, which is just kind of talks to the organization of people really understanding if you're passionate about something, we get it. Kooks, do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, so this last year, we gave to, I think it was called one, yeah, it's 1 Year to Empowerment.
Yeah.
And 1 Year to Empowerment is an organization that over the course of a year, they teach young women to do life skills, whether that's changing a tire to giving a presentation. They actually do hands-on things that help these women gain confidence and also the ability to get out there and be courageous, I think. So you're right, Laura Giorgiani had pitched the year previous, and these organizations that are pitched are so incredible that it's very difficult to choose. But Laura, with a bone in her teeth, came back and again delivered the fact that the 1 Year to Empowerment uses this money in a really empowering way to young women. And I think what really speaks to us as a small organization is we want our monies to go to organizations where it'll have the biggest impact. So we try, I think as a group, we try not to give money to organizations that are already well-funded. We look for where we can make the biggest bang for our buck. And that was 1 Year to Empowerment.
Yeah, that sounds really good. And I guess you want to make sure that the organization that you're giving to has good oversight and that the money is going to the recipients as opposed to just the administrative costs, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. We've also given to a Kings Pointers organization called the Women Offshore Foundation, and Ali Sedano, I'm not sure what class she's from. Do you know,
2007, I think.
Yeah, she's a super powerful woman that took it upon herself to grow this foundation, and they're promoting the support of women in the offshore industry. And I think Ellie, of all the people I know across the industry, has the most energy and gives most of herself to the women who want to go out to sea.
Yeah, that's so fantastic.
A huge range of organizations that we've given to.
Yeah, there's been a big range, and we do have a very, very specific committee that looks exactly at these charities and makes sure they are exactly what they say they are, and the vetting is very thorough when they look at, and that's just so you can pitch it. We make sure before you pitch it that it's actually, you know, every box is checked.
I'd just like to have both of you say a little bit of something to women who are aspiring to be in the shipping industry, whether it's onshore, you know, on ships, on installations, you know, whatever. But maybe start with you, Margaret.
Sure.
What's a little piece of advice you can give these women?
I think you have to really, you have to embrace, if you go to a Kings Point or, you know, any of the maritime schools, you're smart, you know, and you work hard, and you need to just always embrace that. You know, you may not be the smartest person in the room, but you have to, even if there's times when you feel like you're kind of, you know, fooling yourself, I deserve to be here. And that's how I've always approached it. And I think so many of these women, the climate is changing. There is still some issues. I mean, if you look right now, there are 3 women superintendents for these academies. That's pretty amazing. I've had a lovely chat with Admiral Noonan about, you know, us going back and talking to these midshipmen. But I think the big thing for anyone wanting to work in any of these male-dominated industries is really, you know, own your space. You deserve to be there. And just, you know, if you don't understand something, figure it out. And that's kind of the mantra at KP to get through.
What about you, Karen?
Yeah, I often think with this question of how do we get more women to go to sea or get into the industry, I often try to crack that egg and say, what is it that's missing? Going to sea or being in this industry is, it's not for those who aren't brave, right? So I think that's, there's a certain type person that really needs to know that they're going to challenge themselves and be challenged by others. So I think to Margaret's point, you have to have confidence in yourself and remember that people don't like copies. Be your original, because that's what tends to get you by, or even in a moment of not knowing what the answer is, it will get you to ask the right question and not ask a question that you think they want to hear, right? We are having some challenges around diversity and around being a woman at sea. I think in order to keep yourself safe now, you need to really set goals for yourself and be clear in those goals and let people know what your goal is. It's being clear about taking your own space and protecting yourself, making sure people know that you've got a line that you won't cross. So setting boundaries. And I think there's, for me, whether it's asking for help of a man or a woman, you should know that it doesn't always have to be a woman. There are great people out at sea and in shoreside jobs, out in the offshore industry where you're far from anywhere. There are strong men who are also good people that can help you through those hard times. So I think there should always be a knowing your boundaries and also trying to watch the horizon and look for those people that you can know are trustworthy when you do have those times when you need some help.
Yeah, I think that's a very, very important message, and that is particularly for those of us who kind of came up in the 80s, that, you know, my mentor was a man, and of course he was a man because there weren't any other women, so,
right.
And this was, you know, in law practice, so, you know, it's networking is important, and it includes everyone. You find those who are in your corner.
Yeah, I think when I first sailed Master, it's funny because the crew said, you know, we're going to end up in the home port. You know, they're going to have the tugboats shooting their fire extinguishers over the side. And I said, no, we're headed for San Francisco. We're not going to the home port. Well, we ended up headed for Long Beach. Change of orders. There we were in Long Beach. And the crew, I think, was happier for me than I was happier for me. Over my career, I thought to be invisible and to not make a difference between whether I was man or a woman was the goal. So I never really said anything about it. Now I think the goal is that we don't have to, right? I think it's wonderful. We have a woman on First 10 Forward who'd been a master for over 25 years.
So I want to thank Margaret and Karen for talking to us today. It's really nice to speak with you guys. And, you know, I'm from came up in the 80s too. And, you know, I completely agree with you that times are changing. And thanks so much for your support for women in the industry.
Thank you.